This week in Retronauts, it's the ones, the other ones. Hi everyone, welcome to Retronauts episode 356. I'm Jeremy Parrish, feeling about 356 years old. And this week, joining me from our recent excursion into the original ones, well, this doesn't make any sense, we have on Zoom, because we're not allowed to interact face-to-face with other humans. That's very irresponsible. Don't do it. Let's see. Let's go alphabetically. Actually, you can't really do that because you've got two names that are almost the same. Let's go alphabetically by last name. So that would be, wow, that's close.
That's also close.
All right, we got it. We have a winner by a hair. Who is that?
Yeah, that's you.
Yeah, okay. Hi, I'm Ben Edwards, your favorite Retronaut.
Everyone's favorite. And also another favorite coming soon after him in the alphabet.
I'm Ben Elgin.
That's right, Ben Elgin. If this were school, you two would have desks next to each other. And Ben, you would be sitting behind Benj, and you could like throw erasers and stuff into his hair, and he'd never know.
Awesome.
It would be so
cool. Is there a Zoom function for that yet?
I don't think so. But there's probably an InstaChat filter, or not Snapchat filter, InstaChat. Yeah, that's right. That's Jeremy looking all 356 years old, knowing his technology, what the kids are using these days. And finally, sitting way across on the other side of the room, safely away from eraser chunks and from the teacher's glare, we have
everyone's least favorite Retronaut, Chris Sims.
Aww.
Is here.
Well, okay, so we've got the alpha and omega of popularity going on here, and bringing up the middle, it's me. So anyway, yes, a few weeks ago we had an episode wherein the four of us talked about the annual years in review, and I structured that very carefully so that we could get through the whole thing in a single episode. We would stay on topic, on point, and yet, here we are doing a second episode. Why? Because we didn't manage to get it all in. And it's kind of my fault.
There are so many things.
At some point I realized...
So many things, Jeremy.
That's right. At some point I realized, like, there's no way we're going to do justice to 1991 in the short amount of time remaining. So let's just keep going with 81. But now we have a full, let's say, hour and a half to talk about the year 1991 in video games. And there was a lot to talk about. So we're going to talk about that. As always, this is an annual thing we do where we look back. It used to be every 5, 10, 15 years, but now Retronauts has been around so long that it doesn't make sense to do every 5 years. No, now we're on to once every decade. So what was video gaming like a decade ago? We've already talked about 71, 81. There wasn't a whole lot happening in 71, but we still talked for like half an hour about the three things that were happening in video games in 1971. And then 1981, where there was lots of cool stuff. And now we travel forward in time one decade, and the video games industry is bustling. It's actually, whoa, lights.
Damn,
wow,
bustling a lot.
It bustled right here in the studio. Yes, it was a bustling industry. For one thing, it was actually an industry at that point. There actually was a business built up around video games that wasn't just like, hey, go to the local camera shop at your mall and there's some stuff you can look at behind the counter and maybe play some little blip men. That's very exciting. It was a thing. It was robust. So this week we're going to talk about that. If you want to catch up on what we talked about previously, that was episode 347, which was like a month and a half before this episode, so not too far back. But this one, by golly, this is going to be a humdinger. And then Bob is going to do a 2001 episode, and I guess that means we need to get together at some point, or I need to get together with someone at some point to do 2011. I don't know how much you guys know about that, but it seems only right to give context for a decade ago, but that's... I don't know if I'm ready to devote an entire hour and a half of discussing the retro gaming of 2011. That just seems, yep. I think we've hit the threshold.
An hour where I'm of like, things that don't feel like they should be retro at all yet.
Yeah, right? Like, I still haven't finished my save of Skyrim, my playthrough of Skyrim from 2011. So I feel like I've got to do that before I can talk about 2011.
I've just been playing Skyrim.
Skyrim 10 years ago?
I'm afraid to say that is correct.
Jeepers Christmas.
But this is not a 2011 episode. This is a 1991 episode.
Comfortably
so,
retro.
Yes, comfortably retro. Comfortably numb with our retro-ness. Anyway, so 1991, where were you in the year 1991? Let's go alphabetically again. Benj Edwards, where were you in 1991? Were you playing video games in Gatlinburg?
Yeah, probably.
Yes, I knew it.
I was 10 in 1991, so let's see. I can't remember if I got a Super Nintendo that year or in 92, but I was probably deep in NES gaming at that time, and it was just before I really got into PCs and things like that, so I was doing most of my gaming on an NES, and I had a Game Boy, I think, at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, it's before, you know, we had an old Atari we still played every once in a while. It was before I started collecting retro gaming stuff, like that was a couple of years later, so that's where I was.
All right, Ben, how about yourself?
Yeah, so 91, I was a freshman in high school. So I had just escaped the hell pit that is middle school. So that was great. And I was definitely hyped up for Super Nintendo and saving up all my allowance pennies to buy myself one. Well, we'll talk about exactly when it came out. But yeah, I was definitely on board that hype train. Looking forward and playing all the amazing 16-bit games on it.
And finally, Chris Sims.
Let's see here. Your boy was in South Carolina. I would have been 9 years old. I would have turned 9 that August, which means I was going into fourth grade, which means that was the year that I drew a faithful recreation of the DuckTales NES box art. Like we had a school project to draw what you wanted for Christmas. And so I folded the paper in half and I drew like a gift box on the outside. And then when you opened up, there was DuckTales on the inside, which is one of the most clever bits of sequential storytelling I've ever done, I think.
Very cool.
And, finally I was, I guess I was in high school playing NES games, looking at the Super NES and thinking, boy, golly, if only. Sometimes borrowing my friend's Sega Genesis and saying, this is cool. Where are the RPGs? Actually, I didn't care about RPGs. I was like, where's Mario? Why isn't Mario on here? Yeah, and that's about it. I think I played Battletoads that year and beat it and said, I'm never going to do that again. So that was when I learned to turn your back on bad things. Anyway, so yes, lots going on in the year 1991. And basically at this point in video game history, you had multiple viable platforms. You had computers, and they were starting to consolidate around, you know, the DOS standard. You really didn't have the sort of Galapagos effect that you had with 8-bit systems in the 80s. C64, Apple II were really on their way out. The Macintosh was becoming a non-starter. They would still stick around, but no one cared. There was not much going on with Amiga. Yeah. I owned a Macintosh. That's eventually, but it was not the place to go for mainstream gaming. The Mac ports usually came later and were often compromised. You had Game Boy, you had the NES, you had the Super NES launching, you had the TurboGrafx-16, you had the Sega Genesis. Did I mention that? I don't think I did. In Japan, you had the launch of the Game Gear that would come the following year. No, actually, it was the American launch. That's right. Yeah. You had the Mega CD launch in Japan. So, yeah, there was also the PC Engine or the TurboGrafx Duo, the Turbo CD. Yes, that's what it's called. And, you know, elsewhere, game manufacturers were beginning to ramp up to create all kinds of CD-based platforms that no one wanted, like the CDI. And the 3DO, and you know, things were about to get crazy. So a lot happening in 1991. not all of us had infinite money. In fact, I think none of us did. I hadn't figured out that cheat yet. It's called Be Born into a Rich Family. And yeah, so we had to kind of pick and choose. And so at the time, I only owned an NES. And it kind of sounds like most of you were sort of in the same boat where you had one or two systems.
We had a TurboGrafx-16 at that time too. I forgot that was supposed to be our upgrade from the NES, but I just kept playing the NES because, you know,
better game. You had a sibling who loved video games also, right?
Yeah, my brother.
Your dad loved siblings. Your dad loved siblings. Yes. Also, your dad loved video games.
He didn't really actually. Oh, okay. He didn't have the patience to play them very much.
My mistake.
But he liked watching us play them sometimes. Like he thought it was cool if we could do it. But yeah, my brother bought a TurboGrafx-16 basically when it was kind of new. I think he saved up money for it or something and or traded in a bunch of NES stuff that I regretted trading in.
Yeah, the sibling factor is very important back then. My brother helped, you know, go in split 50-50 on the NES hardware, and then he bought like two games. He bought MLB and he bought Hoops, and then decided, I don't care. So the NES kind of became mine, but it meant there was only the buying power of one person purchasing games for that system. So it mm-hmm. limited the library. It was just my allowance, not his.
Yeah. I think we had given up on, my brother had given up on the NES at that point. And I had traded in Super Mario Brothers 3 for China Warrior, which is a great tragedy.
Good pick.
Of all time. So,
but the sprites were so big. They're
so
be
huge.
Good.
Rippling muscles and everything. It's so great. So Super Mario Brothers 3, I remember borrowing it from my friend over and over and over again because I just wanted to keep playing it. Like he'd bring it over and spend the night and we'd use the Game Genie and beat it while we were floating and stuff. It was fun. Good times.
I think the Game Genie launched in 91, didn't it? Or was it 92? I think it was 91. Yeah.
I loved that.
So that transformed everything.
Yeah.
My God.
That was my favorite thing ever.
Yeah, so anyway, with this episode, we're going to do like I had intended to do with last episode, where each of us talks about one piece of hardware, and each of us talks about three notable games. But first, I'll go through the list of games, notable games for the year. This is not a comprehensive list. It is an alphabetical list of things that are interesting, and we can each say one sentence about. There was the Action 52. Are you guys familiar with that?
Yes, but only from people making fun of it on the internet.
Right. So here's the one sentence rundown. That was an unlicensed cartridge from, I don't remember, the Cheetahmen folks. Anyway, yeah. Its whole gimmick was that it had 52 games on it on one NES cartridge, and it cost $200, and all of the games were terrible, but it did have Cheetahmen.
Active Enterprises,
that's right.
Yeah, I wanted it bad because I saw an ad for it in like EGM or something. It said, you know, 52 games. So I think I asked my mom to buy it for me, like mail order, but she never did. So
dope. There you go. It's probably just as well. That would have gone down with China Warrior with you when you're in your dark memories. All right. ActRaiser, which was originally one of the games I was going to highlight, but not enough people were talking about signed up for Sega stuff. So I nobly sacrificed my opportunity to talk about how great ActRaiser is again. Instead, I'm going to talk about Toe Jam and Earl. So ActRaiser, anyone have a one sentence thought?
Yeah, I had ActRaiser near launch and it just blew me away. Like the soundtrack, especially, but.
Oh, they just, Wayo Records just put up pre-orders for the soundtrack. By the time this episode comes out,
it'll
probably be too late. But actually, I think they keep their records in stock for a while. So it is one of the great video game soundtracks and available now on CD and vinyl.
Yeah, I think I can buy that.
ActRaiser is the only game I ever beat on the Super NES through emulation. The only one I ever played through the whole thing, I think, because I didn't have it. And I think I was in high school. And Super NES emulators are new, and ActRaiser was just a game I happened to download, and I thought it was great. So it was fun.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think the only game I ever beat on a Super NES emulator, like the only Super NES game, was Final Fantasy II, aka 4, which I had gotten to the final battle of on a rental and never finished. So I was like, I'm going to do this. But then I realized, I don't really enjoy emulating games that much. There's just something off about this. So
yeah,
that's my snobbish opinion.
I've always felt that way. It's something, it's just one of those weird things. It's like there's a flag in my brain or something that's not fulfilled when I'm using emulation. I use it all the time for references and stuff.
Yep.
But not for playing that much.
Adventure Island 2. Did anyone play this? I've heard good things about it, but it's one I've never had the chance to play.
Yeah, I rented it when it came out, I'm pretty sure. I loved all those Adventure Island games, but never owned them for some reason at the time.
Yeah, I remember seeing it in stores, but it's not one I ever had.
It's just neat. A platformer with more features than Adventure Island 1, I think.
Pretty much. All right. There is Another World, also known as Out of This World, which was a pretty groundbreaking game at the time with the use of polygonal graphics and rotoscoping and fancy effects like that. Very cinematic, very punishing, very cruel, but cool.
Yeah, it's one of those you have to see it in motion because it's all about the, you know, low poly graphics, but it's all about how they move.
The frame rate's good, I think, isn't it?
The frame rate's okay. I mean, I guess it depends on the platform you play on. It was originally an Amiga game, but it made its way to like everything, including consoles, where it was pretty choppy, but still impressive. Developed pretty much by one guy, Eric Chahi. We've talked about, I think we've had an episode on Another World, so we don't need to belabor it, but a very influential game, kind of in the Prince of Persia vein, but taking it to the next level.
I think I rented it on Super NES and it was just so difficult, I didn't get into it.
So I'm going to skip over the things people have put their names next to so we can talk about them in greater depth, but there's jumping ahead to Battletoads. Anyone have angry memories about this one?
Absolutely.
All right, let's hear it. Chris, you've been quiet, so you get four sentences.
Yeah, I didn't know anything about 71 or 81. So Battletoads was so appealing to me because, A, it was pretty clearly like a riff on Ninja Turtles, which were still pretty huge in 91. B, they had like comics that ran in Nintendo Power that were all about how cool Zitz, Pimple, and Rash were. Jeepers Christmas. And like the game looks good, like the big, you know, punches, the big boots, like the foot that turns into the boot and everything. It's a good looking game that's so appealing that is like should not be that hard. It is for babies. It is clearly for children. Why is it so hard?
Because it is from the British microcomputer gaming heritage and therefore does not believe in playing fair, being completable. Like I said, I beat it once and I feel like that was just sheer luck. And I realize I should never go back and try to do that again.
I'm pretty sure I rented it and I don't think I ever made it more than like halfway through.
I love side-scrolling beat-em-ups. Like, I love a Final Fight. I love a Streets of Rage. But even today, I am wary. Like, I was looking at Streets of Rage 4, like, yesterday, and I couldn't figure out why I was so reluctant to buy it, because it looks good, and I've read good reviews. And I was like, oh, it's because of Battletoads. It's all because of Battletoads.
It scarred you, huh?
Because I got so excited and rented it. And when you gave Blockbuster $5... It was a lot of money back then in those 1991 days. You had to play that game all weekend. And if you hit a wall, you hit a wall.
Yeah, it was
different. Perhaps literally in this case. That speeder bike stage was a lot of hitting walls.
Oh, the worst.
We could do an entire episode on Battletoads at some point. I guess we probably should. But anyway, next is on the list is Bible Adventures, another unlicensed game. There were a lot of these back in the day. This one slipped beneath the radar, I think, by being a Super Mario Brothers 2 clone starring Noah. And I think the idea there was Wisdom Tree said, Nintendo won't sue us in America if we wrap ourselves in the Bible. And they were right.
Yeah.
If anybody wants to hear a full-length episode talking about Bible Adventures and other Wisdom Tree games, episode Nintendo 64 of Apocrypals right here on the Greenlit Podcast Network.
Wow, is
a good
nice.
Place to check out.
Well done.
I did a slideshow about religious video games at one point, and this was one that I said was cool because I bought this. I think I bought it, you know, at a used game store just out of curiosity. I thought, wow, this is really neat because you can pick up animals and toss them in your ark.
Oh. What?
Sorry. Somebody got the power.
So that was God's wrath. Anyway, another unlicensed game on the list here, Bubble Bath Babes, which was developed by...
The opposite
by,
of Bible Adventures.
The opposite of Bible Bath... Bible Bath Adventures. I like that. Yes.
Next we'll have Bible Babes.
Bible Bath Babes.
This was a part of a suite of semi-erotic video games released in Japan that a company called Panesian decided to release unlicensed in the US. And I actually never played this game, but I did see it because they had it at my local rental shop right next to all the other video games, like as a rental. It was a, you know, I grew up in a very conservative city, so it was very strange to me that there were these three Bubble Bath Babes and the other ones, Hot Slots and Peekaboo Poker, I think was the third one. Yeah, I don't know. It was weird.
Why they were in your store, because you were in a conservative place.
Probably. But that you were they weren't behind a beaded curtain or anything. It was just like right there, right there at Hastings, right next to Super Mario Brothers 3. It wasn't alphabetized very well. Bubble Bobble, Bubble Bath Babes. Surprise, which one is which? Kids, try them both. See what your mom thinks.
That's a puzzle game, isn't it? Where you arrange bubbles into
And there's like a woman in the bath in the background.
Yeah, I mean, was this still the era before the ESRB? Like there was a whole period where retailers had not figured out the video games had more than one audience yet, I think, and so stuff was just kind of all shoved together.
Yeah, the ESRB was still a couple of years away. Nintendo hadn't thrown Sega under the bus quite yet for Night Trap. All right, moving along, there was Eye of the Beholder, a first-person dungeon crawler based, I believe, on the Dungeons & Dragons license.
It would almost have to be,
I'm pretty sure Beholders are a D&D thing.
They are Wizards of the Coast intellectual property, or TSR intellectual property at the time.
There's F-Zero, the futuristic racing game. It's one less than F1.
Do you know how old I was when I got that?
I was about 43.
I was in my 20s when I got, oh, it's F-Zero like F1.
Are you saying that's real? You're not just making that up. It's a pun on F1?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I just got it at 39.
Bench was today years old.
Yeah.
But yeah, I had F-Zero back on my Super Nintendo when I was in high school. And it's really, I know I was about to say the only racing game, but I did also have Mario Kart. But yeah, F-Zero was the one like semi-serious racing game that I actually got into back in the day, or really ever.
I honestly feel like it's probably, in my experience at least, like the best racing game of its era. Not just because like the racing is fun and exciting and fast, which it is, but like also it has characters. And obviously we found out a lot about Captain Falcon over the years and how good he is at punching. But we never really learned about Dr. Stewart or Pico.
That's because
or Samurai Goro.
There are quote unquote characters, but nowhere in the actual video game. It's only in the manual.
Yeah.
They exist entirely in ancillary. It's like Ewoks. You never hear their name on screen, but everyone knows that they're an Ewok. Everyone knows that there is a Samurai Goro or whatever. Mr. EAD. All right. Next up, Final Fantasy Adventure, secretly a mana game. Mana. Apparently it's localized as mana now. Sort of Mana was what the remake was called. We've talked about this on a previous episode, so we can skip on ahead to Game Boy Wars, which was the 8-bit version of Advance Wars,
Famicom,
which was actually the portable version of Famicom Wars. So yeah.
I did not know that.
Yep.
By the way, F-Zero was the bomb. You didn't give me a chance for my sentence.
Oh, okay. Well, there's your sentence. What do you think of Game Boy Wars, Benj?
I've never played it, but I've tried Famicom Wars once, and it was really neat. I wish we had had it in America. I mean, it would have been really cool.
Yeah, so it's a strategy game developed by Intelligent Systems, close personal friends of Nintendo, for Nintendo systems, and basically is a turn, like a side-based military simulation where you control units and they get into battles and destroy each other and you can upgrade and so on and so forth. Pretty straightforward, like a very sort of stripped-down take on the hex-based PC strategy simulation that was very kind of popular at the time, but a pretty good consoleized interpretation of that genre.
It's all very like cute, rounded, cartoony machines of war going at it.
Yeah, they're so adorable. You just want to pinch their little cheeks while they're dying en masse. Next up, Lagrange Point, which never came to the U.S., but is notable for being the technical highlight of the Famicom catalog in Japan. Does anyone want to jump in and explain why?
Man, I've heard the name, but it's escaping me at the moment.
Okay. I guess I'll monologue about this for four sentences.
Jeremy Parrish written all over it.
Lagrange Point was a Konami game that made use of one of Konami's special Japan-only mapper chips that enhanced the capabilities of the Super or the, of the original NES, the Famicom. And everyone knows about the VRC6 that was in Castlevania 3 in Japan and gave it like all these extra sound channels, so the soundtrack was great and there was better animation. But Lagrange Point went a step above that and put an actual FM synth music chip in the cartridge. And so the soundtrack for this game actually sounds like basically a Sega Genesis game kind of blended with NES sounds. It's very, very complex. It's like,
nice.
I want to say there's like 20 sound channels or something. It's some crazy number, but it's a turn-based role-playing game. Very Phantasy Star looking, very much in that vein. Nothing really amazing or spectacular, but the tech trick, you know, behind the soundtrack is crazy. And I will toot my own horn and say that I wrote the liner notes for the Lagrange Point soundtrack release from Ship to Shore Phono, which is probably out of print at this point, but I'm sure they will republish it someday, maybe. I don't know. Anyway, very impressive. The VRC7 chip that it included was only used in one other game, which was a Tiny Toon Adventures game in Japan that did not make use of the special sound chip. And so when it came over to the U.S., it was just a normal NES game. The end.
I think that's why I never played it, because it's probably not, it didn't work on emulators or something at the time when I was trying a bunch of games, and it probably doesn't work on the flash carts because I don't know if they support, I don't know if EverDrive supports.
Yeah, EverDrives at this point support all those crazy mappers.
Okay.
So it would have the expansion audio for sure.
Yeah, I gotta try it out then.
Yeah, definitely. It sounds great. It is, you know, there's a fan translation for it, so it's worth playing.
That's awesome. Yeah, this is weird. That's one of the few really cool, weird Japanese NES games and Famicom games I've never really tried. I don't know why.
Well, there you go.
It's your fault, Jeremy. I blame you.
It's me. I sucked the oxygen out of the room. All right. So fortunately, the next guy we're going to talk about does not require oxygen because he's a robot. His name is Mega Man 4. That is his name. He gets a new name in every game. Like Mega Man 2 starred. They tore down the original Mega Man, just dismantled him and built a new one, Mega Man 2. That's why the games are called what they are. Anyway, Mega Man 4, in my opinion, probably the worst of the NES Mega Man games. But you may have different opinions.
No, I think 4 was pretty much where I burnt out on on the NES series.
I don't think 4 is bad.
I don't know that it's terrible, but yeah, I guess I started with 2 and I love 2 and 3. And so then I picked up 4 and I was like, it's okay. And I stopped buying them.
5 and 6 were the ones that definitely gave me the, like, oh, we've stopped trying sort of feel, which I think it is not coincidental that I believe definitely for 6 and I think for 5, like X was out at the time already. But I think 4 is still pretty decent. Like, I think the bosses are cool. I like Pharaoh Man a lot. As a design, I think he's pretty cool. So,
all right. Well, I disagree, but that's okay. If Mega Man 4 introduced the charge shot for the series, where you could hold down the fire button and Mega Man would charge up a super-powered beam, which kind of gets rid of the whole point of changing weapons. And also, they hadn't really balanced the game around it, so you basically spend all your time just like standing in place, charging up a shot, shooting an enemy, destroying it in one shot. Otherwise, it's really kind of tedious to play. It's still tedious that way. It's just tedious in a different way. And also, the sound of your blaster charging up knocks out one of the audio channels. So it like diminishes the quality of the music when you're charging. So I have issues.
Wow.
All right.
I gave up on at Mega Man 3. That's when I stopped Mega Man.
Good Mega choice. Mega Man 6 is actually very good. But Mega Man 4, meh. Nah.
Yeah. Skip it. I wanted to buy that so bad, but my brother convinced me not to for some reason.
He was like, no, buy China Warrior. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah, probably. He was like, TurboGrafx, man, is the way to go.
All right. So also another robot in space, Metroid 2, that lady Metroid.
Metroid's she's not a so, robot.
She's such a cool automaton. She's like, she could be in a Nier game.
Yeah, unfortunately, I missed this one. I had Metroid and then, of course, Super Metroid a little bit later. But I actually didn't have a Game Boy at the time it came out. So I missed it.
Didn't we do a whole episode on Metroid 2? I was on Return.
Not on Metroid 2, but we did talk about Metroid 2 in the Metroidvania episode and in a Metroid episode. It's been discussed.
Yeah, I don't like it that much. I had it when it was kind of new, and I didn't like the animations and stuff. It was tricky.
Okay.
I don't know.
On the PC side of things, there was Monkey Island 2, LeChuck's Revenge, which is not a game that I've really spent any time with playing, but I've certainly learned a lot about it as I've been assembling the retrospective book for the Monkey Island anthology that Limited Run Games is putting together. And I basically feel like I could finish the game with my eyes closed at this point. It's been very educational, but I know Bob is a huge fan of this game and has put together an episode dedicated entirely to it. So listen to that episode dedicated entirely to Monkey Island 2 and get yourself learned. Did you guys play much of this one?
No, I didn't have a PC. I mean, I'm sure it got a Mac port eventually, but it was always like late. So,
well, fortunately, Bob is here to pick up our slack.
I played the third one, which is that's Curse of Monkey Island.
Curse of Monkey Island.
Jeremy, did the episode where we play the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy game, did that ever get released?
Yeah, that was a patron exclusive.
Okay, good. So if people have seen that, they know that I hate adventure games. I hate them so much. I went back and played Monkey Island 1 and 2 after I had played through 3. And I was like, oh, without like the voice acting and like the cute cartoony like animation style, I do not like this as much. Like I can respect it, but it was not for me.
And that's fair. I'm more of a Mega Man 2 and 3 kind of person than a Monkey Island 2 kind of person. But, you know, that's why, like I said, Bob picks up our slack. So, hooray. Anyway, Paris All-Stars, sort of a spin-off sequel-ish sort of thing to Bubble Bobble, kind of spun off from Rainbow Island. It's a game where Bub and Bob are little fat kids, and they have little fat umbrellas, and they shoot little parasols around. I never really quite got this game. What's this game? What's up with this game?
It's all about avoiding rain with parasols. No, is that sun?
I think they're multi-purpose.
Okay. Well,
so what you're saying is you don't actually know what the game is about.
I've played it, you know, but it's not. I play it for like 2-5 minutes, something like that. Whenever I've got there's a good port on the Atari ST of Parasol Stars that I play every once in a while. It looks really nice. But
so you do know what it's about.
Yeah. Don't you shoot rainbows or something out of your parasol?
That's Rainbow Islands.
Okay. Then I don't know what it's about.
Okay, this was a good conversation. All right, let's jump ahead to Princess Tomato and the Salad Kingdom, an adventure game for Japanese PCs and NES by Hudson, yes, which we've actually had an entire episode on, so you can listen to that. But if someone has opinions and wants to talk about Percy, then that is by all means do it.
I mean, yeah, this became a lot of memes, although maybe only on one message board. But yeah, you've got this sidekick Persimmon, which is basically the game's way of talking at you through an NPC as you're Sir Cucumber, I think. You're a knight that's a cucumber trying to rescue the Princess Tomato. But yeah, your squire is this little Persimmon, and he basically tells you what you're supposed to be doing as you go through puzzle solving. And then every once in a while between episodes, he drops all your stuff. And I'm pretty sure this was just like the game's mechanic of not having to have a huge inventory and getting rid of things you don't need anymore. But it just comes off as your sidekick being annoying and incompetent. So it is rife with humor potential, perhaps unintentionally there.
That's as good a description as I can possibly muster for myself. All right.
I love salad.
You love salad?
I love salad. Yeah.
You murderer. You can't believe you're eating all these adventure game heroes. jumping ahead, there's Streets of Rage, which, again, we've done an entire episode on with, let's see, that was with John Linneman and Stuart Gipp. Earlier, I guess, at this point last year, 2020, but a great fighting game, kind of Sega's answer to Final Fight for Sega Genesis, and influential both in terms of gameplay and design and in terms of music, because once again, that guy, Yuzo Koshiro of ActRaiser fame, who we talked about earlier, pumped out some jams for this one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's like immediately what I think of with Streets of Rage, is just Koshiro's soundtracks.
It's still, the themes are still resonant even today.
This game is fun to play with one of my BX95 joysticks. That's what I built two of them just to play co-op Streets of Rage with my kids, and it's really fun.
Awesome.
Yeah, I was never a Genesis fan, a Sega guy. I think we've talked about that before in my weird childhood to anti-capitalist feelings about the Genesis.
Yeah, there was some weird classism going on, I remember, yeah.
Yeah, and look, I know it's fake. I know it's all in my head from when I was a 9-year-old. So, but this is one of the ones where I have to admit, like, yeah, this, as much as I love Final Fight, like Streets of Rage is, it's better. Like, it is a more refined and more enjoyable game, I think. Mm-hmm. And I also only trust my fists because I know the police will not help me.
That's not actually in the game, unfortunately. That is a meme that was edited.
It is true, but I
thought it was a real thing, and I posted about it, and then people were like, yeah, no, that's not real. And I thought, well, that explains why I don't remember ever seeing it in the game, but it's not like I was paying a lot of attention to the story in Streets of Rage. I was just punching people and aliens.
Well, there are these streets.
Mm.
And you're very angry.
I want to say one thing about the Genesis that may, I don't know, Chris, if you never liked the gamepad on the Genesis, you know, the control pad, I don't know what they called it, but I never really liked Genesis games, but it turned out that I didn't really like the controller that much. So when I built the control, my own joystick, the Genesis took on a whole new life because it really good controls all of a sudden. So
yeah, I don't know why, like, three buttons side by, like, in a line, that's a weird setup, right?
For NES person, yeah, but otherwise.
I mean, like, unless you play it, like, yeah, where you have your fingers on the buttons instead of
your thumb. If you play it like an arcade board, like, where you're hovering over the buttons, it makes more sense, but...
Yeah, actually, that's the way I play with, like, my arcade joystick I built. I've got a finger on each button, so it does make more sense that way. I don't know.
What do you do with your pinky?
Just let it sit there, kind of.
Hmm. You don't stick it out like you're making tea? Like,
both in arcade... And benches, boxes are some, I mean, it's a, your boxes are pretty substantial size. So, like, it makes more sense to have your whole hand over it than to, like, hover your whole hand over a little controller, console controller.
Yeah.
So there's Streets of Rage, and speaking of Rage, there's Super Ghouls and Ghosts, everyone's favorite series, right?
I heard it was real hard, so I didn't buy it.
Okay. Chris, this seems like the kind of game you would have played and been very angry about, and then would have an anecdote about how angry you are.
No, you nailed it, but that's it.
Did I give away the story? Damn it.
In the same way that I love Castlevania, but... I have never beaten Castlevania 1 because it's difficult. Like, I never got into ghouls, ghosts, and or goblins. It's too hard, and then they make you play it again.
They do. This one at least has a double jump.
Who made you play it again?
Satan.
The game made you play it again.
It just keeps going.
Satan makes you play it again because it's a trap devised by Satan. It's an illusion.
I did recently get, I bought Battle Princess Madeline, not realizing how much it was exactly that game.
It's Satan again.
Yep.
But it's cute and fun. So
it looked pretty though. I liked looking at it in Nintendo Power and not actually playing it.
The story of Battle Princess Madeline being that the designer, like, played Ghouls and Ghosts with his daughter, who's like a little kid, and she liked it so much that like he made her like a version of it. That's a really sweet story, except for the part where like I'm sure she enjoys it. I can't imagine an adult making me play that game as a kid. I would have had a nightmare, but I imagine I am not as good at video games as today's kids with their Fortnites.
I have toyed with the idea of whenever I ground my children from video games because they're playing them too much and they don't do their schoolwork or something, I'd say like, here's an Atari 2600 and a couple cartridges. This is all you get to play. See what happens. I haven't tried it yet.
What's the best punishment game you could use? Like, Battletoads might be a good one, I think.
Yeah, Golden Ghosts or whatever would be pretty, you know, gosh, those games are so insanely frustrating to me.
I like that, Chris. Beat the Turbo Tunnel or no dessert for you. All right, so we need to move along. There's Tecmo Super Bowl, which is like Tecmo Bowl, but it's more super. People still play this and tweak it for current players and rosters and stats. Amazing. People are such nerds, and sports people are the biggest nerds of all. Don't deny it.
How did they get away with that name?
Tecmo Super Bowl?
Yeah, because like you can't like... NFL is really protective of Super Bowl.
Yeah, that was before the NFL got really protective.
Yeah, this is 1991, so
things were different back then. It was the slightly Wild West. And speaking of slightly Wild West, there was Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Turtles in Time. How about that for a segue? Yeah.
Yes.
Where the Turtles could actually fight through the Wild West.
Yeah, that was a great one. I love Turtles in Time. It looked really, really good. It was like super bright colors in your eyes all the time. And then it just had like fun extra mechanics, like the ability to like throw your enemies like into or out of the screen. It just did a lot of fun things.
Great game. Really good.
That is so cool. Like the first time you see it in 1991, like throwing a dude at the screen, like that's so cool.
It is.
And then they made a boss battle out of it, the mechanic, which was also just a cool idea.
Well, you know, Battletoads has that too.
That's true. That's true. It did happen in Battletoads.
But it's less cool.
This game doesn't hate you is the difference.
It's true. It's true. Yeah. I mean, it's a quarter muncher, but you can keep popping in quarters and eventually beat Shredder and Krang and, I don't know, Baxter Stockman. Let's see. Rounding things out, there is Treasure Master, a mediocre NES platformer that had a gimmick, which was not part of the game. The gimmick was that if you could beat the game and jump through some certain hoops, you could be entered into a contest to win some sort of enormous cash prize. Did any of you actually take part in this madness?
No.
When I bought the game used, you know, many years later, I was surprised to learn that was part of its, its thing. Because I didn't get the box or the manual, and I think it tells you on the first screen or something about the contest. So. Crazy. Yeah,
really kind of limits the lifespan of that game. Like, oh, well, what's the point of playing it at this point?
Yeah, the game is terrible, as far as I remember. So
I said mediocre, but maybe it's terrible.
It is terrible because I don't remember anything good about it. That's what my memories are.
It has been a long time since I played it for like 3 minutes on an emulator and said, okay, I'm done. So I don't remember the specifics. But yes, the meta game was the most interesting thing about it. And finally, there's Turrican 2. A game by Factor 5, I want to say. Huge kind of Contra-esque game, very popular in Europe. Never really caught on here too much, but the Europeans do love their Turricans. And, you know, I can understand because they only got Probotector. They didn't get Contra. All right, so that is our brief survey of notable video games for 1991. We're going to take a quick break, and then when we come back, we are going to talk about hardware and more significant games, although, you guys, we didn't restrict ourselves to a single sentence, so now we're going to have to jumble it up. What's wrong with us? I don't know, but we'll find out after the break. All right, so that was a break, by golly, amazing. Now we are back, and we're going to talk about the hardware of the year, 1991, and we're going to start with the Lynx 2, which Benj wants to talk about.
Yes, excellent. This is the second version of a console originally released in 1989, which I'm sure, did we do a Nines episode? I guess we did.
We did. It was 2 years ago.
It has a 6502 based CPU, 160 by 102 screen resolution, which is super tiny. It's like a postage stamp.
Mm-hmm.
California Games as a pack-in game. And the Lynx is the world's first handheld game console with a color LCD display, the original one. It began its life as a handy boy, an engineering project at Epix, the game developer. And then Atari bought the technology and released it. And the Lynx 2 was slightly smaller. It's
significantly smaller.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I have both of them, and I guess it trims off a lot, but it's thicker, which is weird. And it has a slightly better screen. The funny thing is it adds a stereo headphone jack where the original didn't. And I don't even know if the games support stereo audio that much. It has a power LED and the original didn't. The cartridges are easier to insert. The first one had a door that you had to open and then you put it in. And then this one, you just slide the cards in the back. And I think it was launched at a $99 price. This is the Lynx 2. And so with a new marketing campaign. And the battery life is an hour longer than the original at 5 hours, supposedly, and under.
Yeah, the Lynx had extremely variable battery life. It depended how ambitious the game was, because basically the hardware had theoretically unlimited sprite pushing capabilities with its blitter. But basically, the more it did, the more sprites it pushed, the more power it consumed. So if you were playing a game that was really, really sprite intensive and did all kinds of scaling and stuff, like probably like Blue Lightning or something, it was just going to destroy batteries. Whereas, playing Ms. Pac-Man was going to be like whatever.
Yep. 6 AA batteries, though. Mm-hmm. A lot of batteries. And I got a Lynx kind of when it was still kind of new, as someone who called my BBS sold me their Lynx just through the mail. And I got a Lynx. I bought Ms. Pac-Man, and I had Rygar and Batman Returns or whatever, and it was pretty neat.
All right. Well, I have a Lynx 2, which has been modded by McWill so that I can capture video from it. And I'm awesome. Looking forward to a day when there is a different option available, such as the Analog Pocket, because it's kind of a cumbersome system. And also, when you play a vertically oriented game, because the screen could switch its orientation, the screen didn't, but the system was designed to be ambidextrous, sort of. Mm-hmm. Playing that when you're outputting to an LCD screen, difficult. Not a fan.
Yeah.
Anyway, the Lynx 2 did not turn around the Lynx's fortunes, and the system would basically cease to be a factor in the gaming market in 92, 93. But it was a good try, 2 years late, but Atari saying, oh, this is actually what people want from a game system.
Yeah.
Ah, well.
The extremely low resolution is just crazy on that thing. There's a serious lack of detail that's surprising even for that time. I mean, not for 1989 when it came out. I mean, a color screen was expensive in any resolution, but I think that was a really big limiting factor, in my opinion, of the games on that platform.
Yeah, it could push a lot more sprites than Game Boy or Game Gear, but they were kind of shrunken down. So, everything has compromises, and making a great portable system is the art of finding proper compromises. In fact, I had signed up to talk about the Mega CD, but I'll talk about the Game Gear instead, because that is the year that it launched, 1991, in the US and Europe. Mm-hmm. And to me, the Game Gear kind of represents Sega looking at both the Game Boy and the Lynx and saying, okay, we've seen what works here. We've seen what they do well and what they do badly. Let's find a happy medium. And so the Game Gear is a pretty good compromise, kind of a midpoint between the low spec Game Boy and the higher spec Lynx. It has the exact same pixel resolution as the Game Boy, but instead of being a monochrome greenish gray screen, it is a full color screen. In fact, it is internally, it's the the Sega Master System, but with a beefed up visual, like a video system. So I think the Sega Master System had a maximum of like 56 colors or something, and Game Gear can do 256. Those aren't the exact numbers, but basically it had a much larger palette of colors to choose from and could display more games at a time or more colors at a time. But it was possible to kind of cross convert Game Gear and Master System games. And a lot of the later Master System releases in Brazil and Europe, where the system kind of thrived and maintained its popularity, actually started life on Game Gear and then were converted over from Game Gear to Master System. But at the same time, you also had early Game Gear releases that were conversions of Master System games. And instead of being, you know, when you get an NES to Game Boy conversion, it was always kind of rough. Mm-hmm. But when you ported a game Master System game to Game Gear, it usually turned out pretty well. Like the system launched with Wonder Boy or Return of Drancon, if you are playing the American version. And it's a really solid conversion. It doesn't really feel compromised, despite the lower screen resolution. So a really good system, in my opinion. And weirdly, you know, I've started covering the all the other portable systems besides Game Boy on my YouTube channel, and Game Gear is the least popular of these. I really figured it was going to be Lynx, but the Lynx videos actually get a lot of views. They do better than Game Boy. Whereas Game Gear is like, anytime I post a Game Gear video, I know my view count is just going to plummet. I'm going to lose subscribers. It's like people really, really don't like Game Gear for some reason. It's bizarre. I thought it was much more popular than that. I can't figure it out.
It's weird. The Game Gear, I never knew anyone who had a Game Gear ever. Any, you know.
I did.
Well, I know you now, but I didn't know you back then. So it doesn't count. Well, tell us about it.
It was bad. it's not a great system. I mean, the obviously the battery life is infamously awful, but even like the games that I had were not fun. Like they felt like, to me as a kid, and I'm sure that this is an unfair comparison, but it is how I felt when I was a kid. There was no functional difference between playing a game on Game Gear and playing like a Tiger Electronics game in terms of like how enjoyable it was. It's just one was in color.
Man, wow. I can't get behind that.
Again, to me specifically, when I was 12 or whatever.
I say like I had, you know, a few years ago, I bought a McWill modded Game Gear. I think I sold it to Jeremy, but
you did. And then I sent it to someone to have another mod applied to it, and the USPS lost it. Very cool.
Oh my God. Well, goodbye.
Extremely cool waste of money.
Gear.
Yep.
Yeah. There's a lot of systems that I never want to let go, but I was willing to let go of that. So that's all I got to say about the Game Gear. Like I hoard everything, but Game Gear.
Man, what is up with people's hate for the Game Gear? It's not a bad system. I don't get it. All right, whatever. Sega just released a little series of micro Game Gears that are in scale with like the mini Sega Genesis and the Mega Mini NES system and TurboGrafx and everything. It's
which is ludicrously tiny.
It's ridiculously small, pretty much unusable. But
that's hilarious.
I bought all of them because they're so stupid. It's just such a dumb idea. I love it. They like,
and it still takes 8 AA batteries.
That's right. No, but they do take AA batteries. They don't have an internal battery, even though they have a USB power port. You can play it plugged into USB power, but then if you unplug it, then you have to use a AA battery or AAA maybe.
Wow,
it's kind of weird. But you know, one of them you can buy a screen magnifier for it, and it actually does. Like at that point, you know. It does feel kind of usable when you have that magnifier on there, but it's just goofy. I love it.
You get like a power pack and a magnifier, and you can recreate the full like Game Boy add-on experience here.
Yep. Yeah. So I did not know anyone who had a Game Gear back when they were viable, but when I was in college, this was probably a couple of years after it had effectively reached the end of its, maybe a year or two after it reached end of life in America and no one was really making Game Gear games. There was a girl I was seeing, like dating, and one night we were just kind of sitting around and all of a sudden she busts out a Game Gear with Sonic. And I was like, I feel like I don't even know you. Where did this come from? And she was like, oh yeah.
20 minutes into Game Gear and chill, and she gives you this look.
Pretty much. It was a surprise not how I expected the night to go, but very, very just memorable, because I was just like, I had no idea this person was secretly a Sega nerd. Anyway, also in 1991, the Mega CD, also known as the Sega CD, launched in Japan. That was a very good add-on, one of the few good add-on peripherals ever for a video game system. Didn't fare too well here, but the Japanese side of things, they got a lot of really good games. And then finally, Chris J. Sims, tell us about the Super NES.
It's great. I don't know if you've heard of it.
I have heard of it.
It's great.
It was good.
I don't think there has ever been as big a shift in what games could be than going from like an NES to a Super NES. Like even going to a PlayStation or on down the line. Like I honestly feel like there's not a ton of difference between like a lot of games that were on PS3 and like a lot of games that are on like PS5 right now, right? Like obviously there are like qualitative differences, but it's not like just like, oh, this looks better. The Super NES, it had Mode 7 graphics, y'all. Mode 7, that's 6 better than Mode 1. it's like getting one of those was like mind-boggling. Because we've talked before, and again, I believe this is something you know about, Jeremy, but like Super Mario Brothers 3 is pretty good and holds up even today. But going into like Super Mario World from that is wild. It's so much more game, like even in just how like big the individual levels are. Like going back to Mario Brothers 3, I think people often forget like how short those levels are. They're really great, but a lot of them are like tiny. The Mario World levels are massive and have multiple exits and
yeah, Mario 3 levels are like tapas and Super Mario World levels are meals.
Yeah. That's the perfect way to describe it.
Thanks.
And then, you know, you get like there are games on Super NES that are still like they still feel good to play. Like Link to the Past, I think, is still a really, really solid game. There was obviously like a little bit of not every game is good, but I feel like a lot of the big games that are even a little disappointing are disappointing because people weren't sure what to do with it. Like I wrote down that I wanted to talk about Super Castlevania 4, which I think is not a great game, but I feel like its failings are because they had too many options. Like they were like, well, we can rotate levels. We can have you swing the whip around, and then they didn't like build the rest of the game around those new ideas.
Well, I feel like Super Castlevania 4, and I guess we're shifting topics now because this is another one you signed up for. I feel like Super Castlevania 4's biggest failing is that it wants to be something new, but it also wants to be classic Castlevania, and they didn't do a great job of reconciling those two things. So you have like the traditional power-up scheme where you can get these sub-weapons, but at the same time, Simon Belmont is way bigger, like his sprite on screen is bigger. He has the ability to whip in 8 directions, and because he's bigger, his whip has more coverage of the screen. So for the most part, the sub-weapons are pretty useless, because if you want to hit something, you just whip it. Just like Devo said, I mean, his whip covers like half the screen, whereas in the original Castlevania, it's, you know, a quarter of the screen at most. So, you know, like I'm saying basically the radius it can cover around Simon. And it was only in, you know, left or right. Whereas here it's 8 directions. If you see something, you can just go whoopsh and destroy it. And so why do you need the sub-weapons? It just feels like... Yeah. They said, this is what Castlevania has to be, but what if we did it new? Oops, didn't quite work.
I feel like the inherent, since we're talking about Super Castlevania 4, I feel like the inherent problem with that game is that they went backwards with it, right? Because it's essentially, Super Castlevania 4 could have been the first Castlevania game. It's very straightforward. It's got that same premise. You are a Belmont in a castle going after Dracula with a whip, right? Like, it is just the better, more polished version of Castlevania 1. Whereas if they would have continued on with what they had done in Castlevania 3, with, you know, the multiple characters, the different routes you could take, I feel like that was where Castlevania wound up going. Like, the best parts of Castlevania 2 that never worked in that game and the best parts of Castlevania 3 give us, well, and Metroid and Zelda, like, give us the modern, you know, Metroidvania formula. And I feel like that's the biggest failing, is that they just made the better version of Castlevania 1 instead of making Castlevania 4. Like, I never think of this as Castlevania 4. I always just think of it as Super Castlevania, because that's what it is.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah, in Japan, it was just called Akumajo Dracula, which is the same title as the first game on Famicom Disk System. It just means, you know, Demon Castle Dracula. So this literally was presented in Japan as basically a retelling of the first game. And, you know, they did that multiple times. There was Akumajo Dracula for the Sharp X68000. There was Akumajo Dracula for MSX Computer. And all of them are different. There was Akumajo Dracula in the arcade, which came here as Haunted Castle. I actually did a YouTube video on this a few months ago. And these are all basically Simon Belmont traveling through the castle, killing Dracula. And all of them have a slightly different take on it. Aesthetically, this is definitely the most different take on it. But, you know, in terms of mechanics, it just feels a little aimless. Like, they couldn't quite figure it out.
Yeah. If this had come out, like, today, it would be about Simon Belmont being a sad dad.
Yeah, they did that with Lords of Shadow.
Yeah, that's true. They definitely did.
Yep. So
what a mess. Lords of Shadow.
All right. So, Benj... Do either of you want to stand up for the honor of Castlevania 4?
Oh, it's a great game. But it's Chris's analysis is perfect, spot on, that it's just, it is like, you know, it's not like a logical progression of the gameplay advances from Castlevania 1, 2, 3, et cetera. But I like it. I mean, it's difficult, but classic gameplay.
You actually didn't play it back in the day, but I got a chance to play it on the Super SNES Mini. And it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's not...
The music is good.
It's not a bad game. But it's not... especially for a... It was a launch title, right? Yeah. Like, it still looks good. And plays well. But it's not what... If it was not called Castlevania, we would be talking about it in much more glowing terms.
It lets you whip upward. That's my favorite thing about it.
Yeah, I think it's a fantastic game. It's just not where Castlevania ended up going. But I think there's a segue here into another launch game that I had stuck my name on, Gradius 3, which actually did come out at launch. And I think that we got a lot of things like what Chris was saying about the Super Nintendo being such a leap over the 8-bit NES that are just like there to show off like what we can do with this system. And so in this case, it was more like how much of the like much more impressive sort of arcade shooter experience can we fit onto a home console now? And I got Gradius 3, I think, near launch. And it just blows you away with like these huge colorful bosses that like are filling half the screen and just all this stuff that you can't imagine seeing in a home console game before then. And I hadn't really been playing shooters in arcades. I wasn't making it out to arcades a lot at this time. So I just remember really being blown away. But it's also a case of like reach slightly exceeding grasp in mm-hmm. that like the game has horrible slowdown in a bunch of places because it's not willing to compromise on trying to shove as much of the arcade onto this new console as it could.
Yeah. The slowdown that this game suffers from, basically anytime an enemy appears or shoots at you, the screen just kind of slows to a crawl. And I think it kind of maxes out in the level with the bubbles that you're shooting. Mm-hmm. That was, you know, there's different theories about why so many early Super NES games had that issue. But whatever the case, someone by the alias of Vitor Vitellia went through a couple of years ago and basically reprogrammed the game to take advantage of the advanced SA1 mapper chip that Street Fighter Alpha 2 and Super Mario RPG ran on, which is basically like the chip has a Super NES chip like processor on it that is about five times as fast as the actual Super NES hardware. So it like it can do all these things that the core hardware can't. And it turns out that if you take away the slowdown in Gradius 3, it is an unbeatably difficult, merciless, punishing game. It is so crazy hard. So the slowdown is actually a benefit. It's a secret feature that we never knew about. But yes, there are actually quite a few Super NES launch games on this list, so let's kind of bundle those together. There's also Final Fantasy IV, which you have your name next to, Ben.
Yeah, so Final Fantasy IV was really kind of a turning point for me. I hadn't been super into console RPGs before then. I had played like a friend's copy of Final Fantasy I a bit, but hadn't really got into it because like a lot of that game is a little aimless if you don't already know it. Final Fantasy IV was amazing. You know, just it was one of the first games we got to really focus on character stories. And it all seems a little cliche now with, you know, the bad guy turns out to be related to the good guy and there's someone else pulling the strings. And there's a lot of like telegraphed sacrifices and all these things that have been cliches now, but we hadn't seen, especially in the US up to that point. And so just like, and even though it was stripped down a bit from the Japanese release, just the depth of the systems and the characters and the world was just huge compared to anything we'd gotten in the US at that point. And this is what really sucked me in and made me an RPG fanboy and a Square fanboy for decades.
So I will say that we had seen things like this in the US, but not on Nintendo systems. On Genesis, okay, yeah. Phantasy Star 2 did a lot of the covered a lot of the same beats as Final Fantasy 2/4 a couple of years in advance. But the thing about Phantasy Star 2 is that its interface and its combat system, it's just a mess. It is an indecipherable user interface. I hate it so much. Whereas Final Fantasy 4 takes, you know, the turn-based combat and gives it a real-time twist. So, you know...
Yeah, this was the debut of the active time battle system, yeah.
Right, kind of famously based on F1 races where cars are lapping each other, like the little meters that you saw for the active time battle meters in future games were kind of a visual representation of that. But it just made it so intuitive, even though it was a, you know, pretty challenging game, and it turned real-time or turn-based combat into sort of a real-time hyperactive experience. It felt very intuitive. It was kind of simple and it just made sense. Whereas RPG interface design was not always a huge hit back at that time. So I'd say that's a big part of what Final Fantasy II brought to the genre, Final Fantasy IV.
Yeah, the systems that it solidified just worked so well that you know, Final Fantasy stuck with most of them for five more games. And Lord knows how many other franchises basically copied that setup.
All right, I don't want this episode to turn into like, hey, let's talk about the amazing Super NES, because we have a Super NES episode later this year for the system's 30th anniversary. So instead, let's talk about something completely different. Binge, tell us about ZZT, or ZZTED, if you prefer, if you're British. ZZTED.
Well, I love ZZT. I played it back in the day when it was relatively new, because it was 91, I guess. I downloaded it on a BBS or something in 92 probably. And so it was programmed by Tim Sweeney, who's the CEO of Epic Games, but he founded Potomac Computer Systems at the time. That's what it was called back then. And ZZT is an ASCII character-based game where the graphics are just, you know, letters and characters on the IBM PC. And the cool thing about the game is that it is not only a game, but it's basically a game engine. So Tim, he programmed the game engine first and like an editor, and then made the worlds like Town of ZZT and all that stuff in the editor. And the cool thing is he included the editor for free with the game, even with the shareware version of the game. And so people could build their own ZZT worlds. And in fact, it was flexible enough. It had its own little object-oriented programming language built into the game. So it was flexible enough for people to turn, you know, do some genres that weren't expected. Instead of like an overhead sort of action adventure, you walk around. Usually you walk around, you collect gems, you shoot monsters, you collect ammo, and you have torches for light and stuff. But people would use all those elements and the programmable elements to make, you know, weird like shooter games and racing games and Space Invaders things in the same ZZT engine. And it's amazing. And it's cool because Tim later, he went to create the Unreal Engine just to make the game Unreal. And then that became their huge bread and butter for a very long time.
Oh, it still is. Unreal Engine 4, I think, is what they're currently up to. Is, you know, it's kind of the backbone of many, many games.
Yeah, and they're starting to use it. And, you know, like The Mandalorian uses Unreal Engine to visualize things in real time. It's a really incredible product. So all that started with ZZT in 1991. And it's cool because in 2009, Epic is a local game company for me. They're in Cary, which is right next door. And I started, I don't know what happened. I think somebody invited me to some kind of local game development thing. And I met the people from Epic there. And then I asked if I could interview Tim about ZZT. And so we did a really cool long interview, and it was published in on Gamma Sutra, I think, in 2009. And it's still a really cool in-depth look at the history of ZZT, why, you know, how and why it was made and all that stuff. So,
yeah, you're lucky you got in before Fortnite. Now no one from Epic talks to anyone anywhere.
They still talk to me sometimes just because I'm like, you know, from the old days. And I love their shareware history, you know. I mean, Tim is cool. We email each other.
Oh, well, besties. That's great.
Yeah, we're not besties. But he's a great source. Like he'll tell, you know, he'll give me a quote about anything. It's really neat. Like I asked him about the Gravis gamepad because there was some Jazz Jack Rabbit tie in with it. So anyway, that's ZZT.
All right. Maybe you should also talk about Duke Nukem, which was, I feel like it's other not really, name. Yeah, I mean, it's, there's kind of like a spirituality between the two of them that's shared. They're nothing alike in terms of games, but, you know, the people who made them would go on to do big things.
Yeah, they're connected because, you know, Tim Sweeney was inspired by Scott Miller's Apogee software. That Apogee invented a modern shareware model where they provided the first episode of a game for free. And if you liked it, you sent money and bought the other episodes instead. Prior to that, shareware was like, you get the whole game for free. If you like it, send us money. And there was no like carrot on a stick to really get people to pay for it. So Scott Miller figured out that model and did that with Kroz, which was a game, Kingdom of Kroz, which was a text-based game, kind of like ZZT. And then, Duke Nukem was created, is designed by Todd Replogle and Scott Miller and Alan Bloom III and George Brassard and all these Apogee guys. And they were actually responding to Commander Keen, which was developed by id Software and published by Apogee and was a very huge hit for Apogee and id Software. That was in 1990. And then Scott Miller wanted to do like an in-house, you know, version of that where they own the whole rights to it. And so they developed their own EGA engine, and apparently John Carmack helped them with it a little bit, but it's not the exact same engine as Commander Keen. And it's like an action platform shooter game where you play as Duke Nukem, of course, and you jump around and you shoot enemies and collect little power-ups and, you know, Coke cans and stuff that give you points. So it's neat because it started started a franchise that went on to be pretty popular, famous.
Yeah, I would say the Tale of Apogee didn't turn out quite as well as the Tale of Epic Mega Games, but
yeah,
for a while they were a pretty big deal.
Yeah, they turned into 3D Realms. And according to Scott Miller, when I interviewed him in 90, I interviewed him in 2009 too, just like Tim Sweeney, because I was talking about shareware a lot back then. Duke Nukem sold 70,000 copies, which was, I think it was even more than Commander Keen, sold 50 or 60,000 copies. So it was a really huge hit for them at that time.
Yeah, that's a lot when you're like, you know, a kid in your parents' basement making a video game for a little of nothing.
Yeah, with no overhead. They, right. Like the cool thing about BBS is they could just upload to a BBS and it gets spread and shared by people. And you don't have to have a store presence. You don't have to duplicate. Well, they did duplicate discs and send them out, but they didn't have to print manuals and boxes like the, and put them out in stores. And, you know, it's like publishing on demand. Like somebody buys a copy, you make a disc, you send it out. It's cool.
Nice. So let's mix things up. Chris Sims, please tell us about Batman Return of the Joker.
I have always been fascinated by media that has a sequel in a different medium. And this happens with comics a lot. But Batman Return of the Joker, I mean, very clearly, as it says in the name, this is the sequel to Batman 89. Like, it's the sequel to the movie. The Joker comes back. Or at least that's how it's positioned. And while this is not the height of like Batman being omnipresent in pop culture, which would have been like summer 89, it does come in that slight valley between summer of 89, when the bat symbol is like inescapable, and then summer and fall of 92, when Batman Returns comes out and Batman the Animated Series starts on Fox. So this was like, for me, as a kid who loved Batman and would watch like an hour or two of Batman 66 every day and was reading comics, this was kind of the bridge. This was like the big new Batman media of the year. And it's good. It's really good. Like it, I think it honestly holds up pretty well for, you know, an 8-bit side-scrolling action game. It weirdly has like a pretty deep roster of villains. I feel like Firefly is in this, right? And I think maybe KG Beast is in it. But it's like a bridge between the movie and the comics, right? Because it starts at the cathedral, which is where Batman 89 ends. But then you end up going to like Joker's secret base, which is the Ha Hacienda. That's in the comics.
That's nice.
Yeah, it's a solid Batman game. Like it's a solid game. It's a weird Batman game because he does shoot people with a crossbow, which is not quite Batman's deal, but it's a really good game, and I think it looks good and plays really well still. It's solid. And then it would be, I guess we would get a good Batman game in like 93 or 94 with the Super Nintendo Batman, the Animated Series, the Adventures of Batman and Robin game, I guess it was called. But then it would be a while before Arkham Asylum would come out. So solid game. Looks good.
Yeah, it was very visually impressive. You had some big old chunky sprites, you know, for the NES. And it showed up on Genesis too, where I guess the big chunky sprites weren't quite as novel, but, you know, kind of Sunsoft flexing a little bit, showing off their 8-bit programming chops, which is always impressive to see.
Yeah. Batman looks good in the game too. Like his sprite is a really good Batman sprite. It feels more like comics Batman because he's blue rather than black. But I mean, like, I don't think black would have worked given that that is most of the backgrounds.
Right.
But I like it. I like it a lot.
All right. So keeping things kind of on the Sega front, I did want to talk about Toe Jam and Earl. I've put my name down next to Sonic the Hedgehog, but I don't really know that we need to say too much more about that because we've talked a lot about Sonic the Hedgehog. Whereas Toe Jam and Earl, we've kind of briefly touched on in a roguelike episode, but I don't know. The older I get, the more impressed I am with Toe Jam and Earl, just because it's such a game it feels so far ahead of its time in some respects. You didn't really have many instances of roguelike gameplay on consoles back then. You basically had Dragon Crystal and Fatal Labyrinth were pretty much the same game that Sega produced for a download system for Genesis in 1990, or actually for the Mega Drive. It never came to the US. So it had to be like a randomized game, you know, very compact, very sort of minimalist. But that was pretty much it for the roguelike style, you know, procedurally generated RPGs with permanent death and use ID and things like that. And Toe Jam and Earl has all of that, but it's also, you wouldn't know it to look at it because it doesn't have that sort of rigid turn-based style. And also, it's about like goofy hip-hop aliens crashed on a planet looking for their spaceship parts while they're being harassed by Santa Claus and old ladies with shopping carts. It's not really your typical roguelike style, but it is. And it has two-player cooperative action, even though it's roguelike. So it's a pretty, I don't know, like very forward-thinking game. It was created by Human Nature Studios for Sega Genesis, kind of in partnership with Sega. And it was really just a game. It feels like, you know, the kind of thing that you see all the time now, but 30 years ago, no, there was nothing like this out there.
Yes, more like an indie, like a modern indie game, mm-hmm. takes that sort of attitude, you know, like silly, whimsical, weird, cool mixture of things. Never really got into the first one for some reason, but I love the sequel, which is a different genre, basically, Panic on Funkatron.
Yeah, the sequel's just a platformer.
Yeah, I love that game, though. I've talked about
it. I had no idea that this game was a roguelike until, like, just recently. This was one I completely missed, because I think it's because, you know, just the name of the game, like, Toe Jam, made me kind of dismiss it as, like, part of that wave of, like, kind of gross out.
Yeah.
Stuff which I was not into at all, so I just completely didn't pay any attention to it. And yeah, I just recently found out that it was roguelike, and I was like, what? It was, so that's, it's apparently much more interesting than I gave it credit for.
Yeah, I didn't realize that myself either until John Harris, who guested on our roguelike episodes a few years ago, wrote about it, I think, for Gamma Sutra as part of his like chronicling the roguelike genre series. He had a column that was really, really good. It was like 50 episodes long. It was very in-depth and detailed. But he highlighted this and said, hey, guess what? This game is a roguelike, weird as that may be. I don't think it fits the Berlin interpretation because it's not turn-based. But other than that, it's very true to the form. But also, it's funky and weird. It has like this kind of cool like FM synthesis funk sound to the soundtrack. It's, you know, very much about kind of like, I wouldn't say hip hop slang. It's more like surfer slang. It's just very kind of a goofy, almost nonviolent game. Like there is a little bit of, you know, you have to avoid being attacked by old ladies with shopping carts. But in terms of weapons, I think you can get like tomatoes and slingshots, and that's pretty much it. There's just not a lot of negativity. It's very much the Human Nature style is Human Nature Studios to be sort of lighthearted and bring positivity into the world. So I'm a big fan.
Yeah, I love the feel of the game. All this, the Toe Jam games. There's a weird one on Xbox 2-3, I think.
Yeah, and then there was a sequel pretty recently called Back in the Groove, which is very true to the original Toe Jam and Earl. It makes things a little easier. It's got four-player cooperative action. There's more of a persistent metagame running throughout it where you kind of like unlock things that become permanent elements of the game. But it's otherwise very true to the original. And it does feel very much like it just fits right into the modern kind of a contemporary indie landscape. All right, we need to wrap it up, so I'm gonna be iconoclastic, and instead of talking about one or two of the remaining really big games we have on the list, like Zelda or Street Fighter II, which we'll be talking about in depth later in other episodes. Ben, why don't you tell us about Puyo Puyo?
Puyo Puyo, I was hoping you were going to say that. So Puyo Puyo, I got into it for weird ass reasons. There was like a shareware recreation of it on Macintosh that I kind of became a ringer at in college, and like we had tournaments. But yeah, Puyo Puyo is an odd beast. It's so probably most people have seen it at this point, but it's a tile matching falling blocks kind of game. You have your Puyos, which are these little blobs that think like Dragon Quest slimes, only even rounder and bigger eyes, falling down in pairs or more depending on the game in different colors. If four or more of them connect, they pop. You can do chain reactions. You can send nuisance blocks to the other side. So it's a fairly standard falling block formula, but just like pulled off really well. It feels really good to play. It's very different from, you know, Tetris, which was, of course, the other big thing back in the day. And it's also got this weird history. It's a spin-off of like this little adventure game, Mado Monogatari, from Compile, that never made much of a splash, but the characters came into this puzzle game to be characters in this sort of tournament puzzle that came to arcades. Well, it was, what was it originally on? Now I've forgotten.
MSX.
Yeah, MSX2. But the version with all the versus character stuff was in the arcade, and then that came to home consoles and spun off into a million sequels, eventually was acquired by Sega. But the other interesting thing of it is we didn't get it over here as Puyo Puyo until just recently, because other teams reskinned it. So we had it as Dr. Robotnik's Mean Bean Machine. Was just Puyo Puyo, and then Kirby's Avalanche is also just Puyo Puyo. And then we didn't really get it here. I think we got Puyo Pop on handhelds, on Neo Geo Pocket Color. But then just recently we started getting Puyo Puyo versus Tetris.
It took like 3 years for that to be localized too. It took forever.
Yeah, it took a long, long time, but it finally came out. And it's just a great addictive game. And this is where it started back in 91, even though we didn't see it over here until much later. Did any of you guys play much Puyo Puyo?
I like the Dr. Robotnik's Mean Bean Machine version. It's really cool.
You weren't a Kirby's Avalanche guy?
No, I don't know why.
See, that's good. That's good. Get some Sega repping in here. It's not all Nintendo all the time, folks. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the Neo Geo Pocket Color was kind of where I've sort of discovered the series and was like, oh, this goes back a long way, which actually wasn't that long at the time. It was only like 8 years, but what do you know? And then the first E3 I attended in 2004, there was a little like small games pavilion off to the side, and they were showing Puyo 4 or Puyo 5, I think. I can't remember, or something like that.
One.
I don't know. It was something for like for a PC system, just kind of off the show floor. And I was like, wow, they might actually localize this. That's wild. So that was one of the first articles I ever wrote from an E3, focusing on the important things, you know, the stuff that people really want to read about.
Yeah. Well, that's why your stuff was always cool, because you did hone in on the really quirky, cool stuff that other people weren't paying attention to.
Yeah, thanks. That's just because I was only writing about stuff I really cared about. not stuff that I could actually drive traffic with. And for some reason, I still ended up being EIC for a while. It was weird. I don't understand it. Anyway, so yeah, that's a pretty big rundown through 1991. There are a few big things I mentioned, like
we forgot Civilization.
Civilization, we did not talk about this episode, but we did have a Civilization episode a few months ago. We've talked about Zelda 3 as A Link to the Past in depth. See, I'm so old, I still call it Zelda 3. and Street Fighter 2, actually one of the projects I have in mind for 2021 for Retronauts is to do a survey through the Street Fighter series, like chapter by chapter. So there will be a Street Fighter 2 episode, maybe more than one. It may be one of those games that's so big we have to talk about the spinoffs and the sequels or the alternate versions separately. But that'll be coming later this year. So look forward to that. I don't think we need to belabor the point here. And like I said, we will be talking about the Super NES around launch time. There will be an episode on that. And I don't know, we've got a bunch of other stuff planned for the year 2021, so look forward to it. But in the meantime, this was 1991, not 2021, and we may do a 2011 episode if I can work up the will to talk about Skyrim as if it were retro. I don't know, man. It's It's really, I've got an existential quandary here. I don't know why 2010 didn't seem so bad, but you get to 2011, it's like Dark Souls 2, Arkham Knight, Skyrim. Like, I can't do it. But it was two generations ago. That was, you know, we're up to PlayStation 5 and Xbox Series X now, and those were PS3, Xbox 360. So I don't know, man. I guess we got to face up to mortality at some point.
It's because those games have been ported to more modern systems.
That's true. Yeah. A lot of games
from that Bastion time. Was 2011. Jeez.
Bastion,
yeah.
God dang. And that still gets ports on stuff. Like, didn't it just come out on the Switch not that long ago?
Couple of years, yeah. I guess that's part of it, is that I kind of blame Switch now that I think about it, because it is such a, like, you know, it's current hardware, but it's kind of like a generation ago spec. So it's a popular place. It's very successful. So it's a popular place for games to be regurgitated. So yeah, things stay fresh and viable a lot longer than they used to. It used to be like, well, that game's 6 months old. We're never going to talk about it or sell it again. But that's not really the case anymore, which is good. I think it's good that games are, you know, staying in circulation longer and being ported to newer systems, or in the case of Xbox Series X, you've got backward compatibility that does a great job of keeping basically the entire Xbox 20-year history alive. It's fantastic. So, yeah, nothing really to complain about there. But anyway, that's 1991. Nothing I was just talking about has anything to do with 1991. What can you do? Anyway, yes, thanks guys for joining us. This is the way. This has been Retronauts protecting Baby Yoda since the year 2006. I am Jeremy Parrish, and you can find Retronauts so many places. You can find us on various podcatchers. You can find us on the Greenlit Podcast Network. And of course, you can find us at Patreon, where you can support the show by subscribing, getting every episode a week early in a higher bitrate quality with no advertisements. And if you subscribe for $5 a month or more, you also get exclusive Patreon episodes every other Friday and weekend columns by Diamond Fight, which are also kind of like little mini podcasts. And now that he'd, yeah, Diamond does the reading of the pod, or the columns. Boy, I cannot talk. It's a good thing I am not a podcast host or something. That'd be terrible. Anyway, so yes, check out Retronauts at Patreon and at other places, and give us a listen to the many, many years long back catalog now. At some point, our relaunch is going to be retro. We're almost there, 8 years ago. Wow. So yeah, Binge, where can we find you on the internet?
Probably at Twitter, at Binge Edwards. You can see my craziest, wildest exploits online.
What are you exploiting? Or who? Who are you exploiting,
everyone,
Binge?
Everything.
I see. Yeah,
video games in particular. Joystick people. I just recently built and sold some joysticks for the first time all year, so that was cool. I sold 10 or 11. Yeah, so it was neat. Good Christmas money.
All right. Ben, how about you?
I'm also on the Twitters. You can find me there at Kirinn, K-I-R-I-N-N, doing whatever it is I happen to be doing at the moment.
And Chris Sims.
Everybody can find me by going to the-isb.com. That is my website, and has links to all the stuff that I do. I have recently launched a couple of new projects. One of them is a podcast called Every Pint Ever, which is about my wife and I ranking all the ice cream we eat and also just being extremely married. And I'm about to get started with a new little writing project that I am calling Castlemania, which I know that title has been used for something before.
There's an online retailer called Castlemania Games.
There you go.
I buy stuff from them sometimes.
I am going to be ranking all the Metroidvanias that I play. So I just replayed Chasm, so I can have a nice controversial entry for bottom of the list to start off with.
Excuse me, sir.
Yeah, sorry. Strong opinions. Both of those are going to be Patreon exclusive through War Rocket Ajax, which is a fantastic podcast that's been running for 9 years and is right here on the Greenlit Podcast Network.
All right. And please don't go listen to Chris slamming Chasm. It's a very good game. I love it so much that I put together a 64-page book on it for the limited run release. So, dissenting opinions, sir.
A vested interest in promoting Chasm.
No, because the sale period has already ended. Okay. Limited run has closed sales, so I make nothing from this. It is just a fact of life. Anyway, you can find me on Twitter as GameSpite and doing YouTube stuff on YouTube under my name, Jeremy Parrish. And in a couple of months, I'm actually going to start really recalibrating the Video Works series and talking about Sega's SG-1000 leading up to the Master System, which will eventually come even with the NES chronology. And then from that point forward, it'll be all systems all the time. It'll be great. So that's my mad scheme. And of course, that's supported through Patreon also, but so is Retronauts. So, and so is Chris. So, you know, there's so many Patreons out there. I understand if you can't afford them all. It's totally fine. I'm not going to take it personally. Please watch my videos and share them. Listen to these podcasts, share them. And, just enjoy the fact that the games of 1991 that we talked about, so many of them are still available to play now. So go play some of them and enjoy them. It will be great and you will love it. All right. Thanks everyone for listening. Catch you in probably like 5 or 6 days or 7 days. I don't know. It'll be next time a podcast is up. Yeah, I'm going to stop talking now. Thanks.